But first, most comedians fear the sound of silence in a room, or rather the absence of laughter, especially when trying out new material. Stuart Lee is a performer who doesn't play by the usual rules of stand-up comedy. He doesn't do gags with punchlines, he meanders around subjects, apparently making it up as he goes along, and seems to actually enjoy it when the comic routines fall flat. Often the subject of his shows is his own grumpiness and his weariness at the demands of modern life.
If you've done that at home, if you've stolen one of my live DVDs off the internet, that is the same as just stealing food out of my kids' mouths. Well, not exactly that, but it does delay the point at which we've got enough money to move into the catchment area of a selective grammar. How are my kids supposed to grow up to be campaigners for social justice without the benefit of educational privilege? Hear that? That's the sound of the middle classes applauding their own guilt.
An excerpt from the first episode of the new series of Stuart Lee's Comedy Vehicle, which returns to BBC Two for a third series this weekend. The show intersperses live stand-up performances with filmed sections in which Stuart is questioned by an interrogator, played by fellow comic writer Chris Morris. I suggested to Stuart Lee that his comedy is more self-lacerating than ever.
There's all kinds of ways of being a stand-up, and one way of being a stand-up is to be Mr. Saturday Night, a kind of Bob Monkhouse, Jimmy Carr sort of high status figure. A lot of the people that I like are the sort of low status figures, and I think it's harder for me as a stand-up now to be this sort of low status figure who's allowed to moan about everything.
Because partly because you're on BBC Two.
Well, partly added to that because the show's been, it got BAFTAs and things. I mean, no one noticed because it was cut out of the TV broadcast brilliantly. My when I got the BAFTA, it wasn't shown.
Were you actually there? Because I saw that and I thought, oh, he just hasn't bothered turning up.
No, I did a speech and everything.
But you're also still placing yourself in opposition to the mainstream. And very early on, you start off, and within the live show format, there's a gag which you deliver about finding pornography in your dad's cupboard as a kid, and having a kind of a memory. And I thought, as you were telling the joke, I thought, that's funny. That's not the sort of gag that Stuart does. Yeah. And immediately, a split second later, you say, that's not actually the sort of gag I normally do. Lee Mack.
Partly I get sort of criticism of people saying, oh, he couldn't do all that sort of stuff. So I just sort of thought, I wonder what if you tried to do it and then pulled the rug out from under it. I had an idea a few years ago that it'd be great to ask someone like Michael McIntyre if you could actually just have an hour and a half of their stuff and perform it, but as if you were on the verge of suicide, you know, that kind of stuff about the frustrations of everyday life and marriage and kids. And obviously, no one's allowed me to do that. So I thought, well, I'll just try and write that show. So
Did you ask?
No, I floated it out there.
That's
hoping
a great
that someone
idea.
Would get back to me.
It's like a cover version.
Like a cover version. Like when, you know, Sonic Youth, the American sort of no-wave band, did Robert Palmer's Addicted to Love.
Yes.
It became rather sinister.
Turned it into a dirge.
Yeah, you know. And I don't know that people always notice it. That you kind of assimilate things in order to discard them and then move on, you know, and then you can get ahead onto something else. I sometimes think you have to sort of show people that you could do what they think stand up is, but you've chosen not to.
Well, in the same way that if you look at early Picassos, you know that he could draw and paint brilliantly, and then he could put a bicycle
I'm
seat in a gallery.
I'm not saying Picasso or Peter Blake, but Peter Blake was famously sort of dismissive of the sensation generation of Brit artists when he said, you know, he didn't feel like they knew the craft well enough to be allowed to then move into such conceptual art, and he felt that he'd had to move through sort of doing it. And Simon Munnery's got a great joke, you know, many are prepared to suffer for their art, few are prepared to learn how to draw. So I sort of thought, if you can sort of have a bit of fun showing you can do those sorts of jokes, but then do something else.
Now, we're talking here as if Stuart Lee, the person who we see on television, is the same person that I'm talking to here now. But in a way, the person that you present on that stage is a sort of construct
it's based on you. Yeah, I mean, it's increasingly true that, because obviously in the comedy, I need a degree of nihilism and recklessness and whatever that's no longer actually appropriate to my life as a father of two children. And so, for example, in that very first episode that you're talking about, the opening line is a sort of spin-off of what I sort of imagined was a criticism of me by another comedian. I'm not even sure that it was, but I realised that the Stuart Lee on stage would think it was, and he would sort of react to it in a way that would probably get him in trouble.
Yeah. So you suggest that the line was actually written by Lee Mack his autobiography about you.
Yeah. And it was about being, I don't know that it is.
Right, oh, you didn't.
I read it.
What was the line? It was about being Oxbridge educated, but not being able to be funny enough to be on a panel show.
Yeah. Basically, yeah. And I thought, he's having a go at me, right? And I thought, no, he isn't. And I thought, but me on stage would think he was. So he would do that, you know. Right. So I kind of make a separation between me and this slightly more paranoid, aggressive, smug man who's low status, but he's got low self-esteem, so he's anxious to prove that he's good at particular things or whatever. So you do end up making that sort of difference. And I do sometimes find myself having to... it's like an exaggerated version of things that I don't necessarily like about myself. Like, yeah, he's politically correct, and yeah, he's left of centre, and I do agree with those things, but with him there's also a status attached to that, and wanting to win arguments and wanting to appear better than other people. So at the same time as agreeing with it, I'm suspicious of his motives for taking those positions, you know. So it becomes...
This sounds like you're on the psychiatrist's couch here, but interestingly, in the previous comedy vehicles, you have had this interrogator, and Armando Iannucci has performed the role almost like a kind of benign but quite persistent television interviewer. Yeah. Now you have Chris Morris, and he almost comes across as a shrink, as a psychiatrist, and he's very aggressive.
Yeah, it's very different.
And analysing and interrogating your motives for comedy and suggesting, that you're not very funny.
Yeah, well, I mean, basically, Armando was going to do it, and then he became trapped in Baltimore with Veep, the American thick of it that he produces and is the head writer on and directs and whatever. And time was running out, and so Chris had script edited the program, was literally there, you know, so we asked him to do it.
Oh, so you were working with him anyway, he was the script editor on the program, so you just got him in.
Which meant that he knew the stuff, which was really good, because with those interviews, I don't know... I don't know what's going to be said to me in any way. So
I thought they were improvised. Yeah, so you don't know that the line he's going to take with you.
No, I don't know. And so you film about 3 hours, and then probably about half an hour of it's used over the course of the series.
But
that's
there's a great repartee between the two of you, and you can stand your ground. But every now and again, he said something that was almost so caustic and cutting that you look momentarily knocked off your feet. And there was this kind of a look in your face that suggests you were actually genuinely hurt. Now, either that's very good acting.
No, I'm not at all. In fact, I would prefer it. I would like it to have gone further. But I mean, he's so straight-faced that you have to raise your game and play it straight yourself.
He is the master of deadpan.
Yeah, you can't be seen to be having fun with it, to the point where actually, weirdly, last night, because I was coming in here, I watched the first one again, and I thought, if you don't know me, you'll think I'm arrogant and deranged and depressed, and it's because he created that level of performance in you. So they've come out really well, and they do... it's great to be able to do the material, the stand-up in the club, you do it as itself, and then the interviews suggest that you're doing that your motives for doing it are suspect in some way, or they're about self-aggrandizement or trying to muddle through something you're not really equipped to do. And it's really good fun to create that subtext.
And that element of danger, of awkwardness, of putting yourself there on the edge is still always important. And you said before that the real life Stuart Lee possibly wouldn't be thinking was Lee Mack talking about me, but maybe a little bit hurt that they cut that acceptance speech at the BAFTAs out of the television performance. Now, if this series goes really well, if there's another whole load of BAFTAs, and if suddenly you got, I don't know, booking for 5 nights at the O2, are you saying that you would rather not be doing 5 nights at the O2 because you would prefer to be working the margins of the mainstream?
I can do 3 nights at the O2's worth of people now, but I do it in 500-seater increments at the Leicester Square Theatre, and there's a number of reasons why I do that. First of all, it looks like, oh, what a nice bloke doing that. I can charge half what it would cost to see me at the O2 and still see more of the money, because I don't have to do advertising or get in a huge PA system or whatever. So that's one reason of doing it, is actually, unless you want to be seen to be doing the O2.
Sure, but you've got to work 30 nights rather than 3 nights.
You've got to write 30 nights rather than 3 nights. But actually, you know what? I'm always thinking, while I'm still young enough and fit enough to do it, I'm trying to build an audience for the future. Because I don't know how long we're doing the telly last, whatever. There's always the live stuff. And the people that come and see you in a 500-seater room, even a 1,000-seater room, even a 2,000-seater room, have a much better time with the kind of stuff I do than they would in a 16,000-seater or an 8,000-seater. The next massive tour I'll do, about 2017-18, I'm already wondering, can you do something with monitors that is somehow dishonest? You know, because you know the thing now in stadium stand-up is... you're actually watching the monitor. I sort of think, what could you do? Could you have different parts of a 16,000-seater room getting different stuff at different times? Could what was on the monitor be... could it be a younger, better-looking actor playing me? Now that the grammar of the stadium stand-up gig is established.
It's there to be messed with.
It's there to be messed with, but the next thing would be, how can you ruin stadium comedy? Forever. For everyone. Spoil everyone's cash cow.
Stuart Lee, whose series The Comedy Vehicle begins again this Saturday on BBC Two at 10 o'clock.